Good evening. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday night, April 14th, 2021. I'm Kyle Kellums. Before we go any further with tonight's show, let me share with you what I said at the beginning of our noon show today. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, March 29th, 2021. I'm Kyle Kellums. I said it was March 29th at the beginning of the noon show because I wrote on my script that it was March 29th. What can I say? It's been a long 13 or 14 months, and sometimes it's just hard to keep everything straight. But it is, I promise, Wednesday night, April 14th, 2021. Ahead on tonight's show, Northwest Technical Institute continues to grow. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda gives us details, and we continue to take note of the 150 years of the University of Arkansas with a story about an early 20th century dust-up of sorts that led to the university's most cherished tradition. Charlie Allison will tell us how Senior Walk began. The Northwest Arkansas Council's Healthcare Transition Division will host a pair of clinics this week, beginning tomorrow, to offer free first doses of the Pfizer vaccine. The council will offer the shots free of charge. Insurance will not be required. Those attending the clinics will not need to provide identification or social security numbers. The first clinic will be tomorrow morning, beginning at 8 until 4 tomorrow afternoon, in the former Sears Center in the Northwest Arkansas Mall. A second clinic is scheduled for Friday at the J.B. Hunt headquarters in Lowell. That's Friday from 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. Registration for either clinic can be made at nwacouncil.org/nwavaccines or by calling 479-334-2929. We'll repeat that information at the end of tonight's show. Tonight's numbers from the Arkansas Department of Health include 222. Tonight's numbers from the Arkansas Department of Health include 220 new diagnoses of COVID-19 in Arkansas during the last 24 hours and 7 additional deaths from the virus. Both active cases and hospitalizations increased during the last 24 hours of monitoring. 52 more active cases in the state, 7 more hospitalizations. A bill restricting anyone except voters from congregating within 100 feet of an Arkansas polling location is heading to Governor Asa Hutchinson's desk. Yesterday, the State House passed Senate Bill 487. Like other restrictions recently passed in other states, the bill would prohibit groups from distributing water or refreshments to people standing in line to vote. Democrat Representative Vivian Flowers of Pine Bluff likened the bill to historical efforts to suppress the vote of Black Americans.
Why in the world would we create legislation barring a volunteer without any campaign information, any electioneering on behalf of one party or another, on behalf of one candidate or another, just a nonprofit to provide water? And where does it stop? That is not electioneering.
Supporters of the bill have said it's needed to help prevent efforts to influence voters just before going into a polling location. The bill passed in the House yesterday by a vote of 74 to 23. It now goes to Governor Asa Hutchinson, who will decide whether to sign it into law. Bentonville voters are giving approval to the extension of a 1-cent sales tax to extend bonds for city projects like roads and park and recreation amenities, as well as refunding bonds. Almost 79% of the ballots cast were in favor of the measure. Just more than 1,100 residents voted. It's about 4% of those eligible. And voters in Elkins also approved bond issues yesterday, and again, by an overwhelming margin. Talk Business and Politics reports more than 40,000 pounds of medical marijuana have sold in Arkansas since the first dispensary opened in May 2019. The nearly 43,000 pounds represents a value of $285 million. There are now 32 dispensaries in operation, with another half dozen licensed and preparing to open. The Relief Center in Bentonville is listed as the top sales dispensary in the state. Since opening in August 2019, it has sold more than 4,600 pounds of medical marijuana. The Siloam Springs Farmers Market will be the next market to welcome in the warm weather growing season. Opening day for the Siloam Springs Market Saturday from 8 until noon. The number 11 in the country JBU women's soccer team will open play in the NAIA National Tournament tomorrow evening, beginning at 6, against Baker University out of Kansas. The match will be played at Alumni Field in Siloam Springs. There is a chance of rain throughout the listening area tonight, about a 40% chance of rain during early evening hours. Lows tonight from 44 to 50. Tomorrow, partly sunny. Highs from 63 to 68. This is Ozarks at Large. A nonprofit immigration legal aid center founded by students attending Harvard University in 2019 and now independently operated helps undocumented youth across the United States, including in Arkansas, obtain temporary legal credentials, enabling them to work and drive. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Fernando Urbina, a third-year Harvard University government major, is outreach director for Immigration Help, one word. The nonprofit agency helps undocumented youth to safely obtain temporary DACA credentials, which allows them to legally live and work in the U.S.
Applying for DACA can be a very complicated process. So what individuals need to do is complete these forms, which can be very lengthy. And so also immigration attorneys that help with these forms can cost up to thousands of dollars. And also on top of these attorney fees, there is a high filing fee. So this creates lots of barriers for individuals because, one, many people do not have the money to apply for these programs or to pay for immigration attorneys. And also, they do not have the time or skill levels needed to complete these very complicated forms.
Urbina helps DACA applicants to apply, so understands the challenges. The application process is also expensive, which is where the nonprofit immigrationhelp.org steps in, offering no-cost application assistance.
The typical cost to apply is several thousand dollars because immigration attorneys can cost several thousand of dollars. And on top of that, there is a $495 fee that is required to be submitted to the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services Organization.
Who qualifies for DACA is nuanced, he says.
So currently, individuals must have entered the country before 2007 and must have been 16 or younger to qualify for DACA. And so currently we're following the guidelines of the Obama administration,
which through executive order launched the DACA program in 2015. At the time, Congress was unable to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Things deteriorated further under the previous administration, Urbina says.
Under the Trump administration, we definitely saw a big threat to the DACA program. So he tried to end it several times. The Supreme Court decision last July was a huge temporary victory because it stated that Trump was not allowed to terminate the program, yet he continued to try to terminate DACA and then prevented new individuals from applying to the program. Towards the end of his administration, then the federal court ruled that new applications need to be accepted. And now what we're seeing under the new administration of Biden, which has been very promising, is that he seeks to make the DACA program permanent and also expand it so more people become eligible.
Urbina says more migrants are now seeking DACA status under the Biden administration.
We have helped several thousands of individuals at different stages of the application process. So this includes from helping them determine whether they're eligible or not to helping them completely file their forms to the government.
He says demand for DACA credentials is also rising in Arkansas.
We are starting to expand our outreach efforts in the state because we have seen recently that there is a big demand within the state for our services. And so we want to make sure that we're reaching out to more individuals who might need our free help.
4,500 DACA recipients legally reside in Arkansas. An additional 8,000 qualify for the status. Immigration Help is funded by grants and donations. Tax-deductible contributions are needed and welcome. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Northwest Technical Institute in Springdale has established a nonprofit foundation to help support the construction of a new medical building. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
In 2019, Northwest Technical Institute broke ground on a welding center, the first new building to be constructed on the Springdale campus in about two decades. With that building now open to students and a project to expand the ammonia refrigeration building in its final phases, President Jim Rollins is turning his attention to a new medical facility.
We are absolutely in an expansion mode because the needs of our area are so great in so many areas.
Students are being taught in a general purpose building currently, but the proposed $10 million 50,000 square foot facility would provide an opportunity to create specialty space designed for the teaching of medicine. Rollins says students trained in the new facility will be prepared to join the Northwest Arkansas workforce, which is in need of healthcare workers.
And there are hundreds of vacancies today that far supersede our capacity with our existing facilities to help supply employees for those vacant positions. But this new facility allows for growth, allows for expansion, allows for us to be partners with all the providers in the medical industry to lay the foundation.
NWTI's Allied Health Program readies students to seek employment as a certified nursing assistant, phlebotomist, or sterile processing technician, among other things. Rollins says the new medical facility will create the opportunity to educate more students, including those on a waiting list.
I think this facility, rather than serving 60, 70 to 100 students, could easily double that number, and even more so as we expand from just a traditional 8-to-4 service calendar, if you will, to evening programs and so on and so forth. And we're doing that now.
Rollins says they'll need regional and state partnerships to build the new facility, so they've established the institution's first school-wide foundation. The Northwest Technical Institute Education Foundation provides a way to receive philanthropic gifts to support the $10 million project. Because NWTI is 45 years old, Rollins says they're constantly trying to renovate and reinvigorate the institution.
I love what's happened with our staff over the last several months. We've kind of coined a new phrase, a new NWTI. So that image building process is also very important. As an aspect of this plan, we want our community, the students of the community, whether they be just leaving high school or maybe adults and already in industry who want to come back and upskill, we want them to consider NWTI as a place to do that.
Rollins estimates it will take 2 years to design, construct, and get the new building ready to serve students. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Don't forget, you can share stories you hear on Ozarks at Large through ozarksatlarge.com. You can find the stories there with links that allow you to share them through email or social media. And you can always hear the most recent daily edition of Ozarks at Large by asking your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large. And we have a free daily email newsletter that contains all of the elements of that day's Ozarks at Large program and more information. Again, with links that provide you to share those stories and interviews. You can sign up for the free email by going to KUAF.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by GoTRG, hosting a drive-through community electronics recycling drive Saturday, April 17th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 4900 Southwest Regional Airport Boulevard in Bentonville. Computers, printers, cell phones, and more will be accepted. More information available at gotrg.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. Governor Asa Hutchinson is encouraging, really encouraging, Arkansans to get vaccinated against COVID-19. He devoted much of his prepared remarks at yesterday's weekly briefing about the virus, discussing the need for vaccinations, and a bit of time about the vaccinations themselves. He spoke to the state just hours after the federal government ordered a pause in administering the one-shot doses of Johnson & Johnson vaccines. Following the revelation, there had been rare and severe reactions in six women between the ages of 18 and 48. Governor Hutchinson says he was on a Tuesday phone call with the White House about the J&J vaccine and says the state respects the decision to issue a short pause on those shots.
And we will follow that in Arkansas. We will continue our vaccination program uninterrupted. It continues at a rapid pace, and no one should delay getting a vaccination because of the pause on one part of the vaccination. We have the supply currently on hand in Arkansas to meet the demand needs of our state. No one should slow down and say, well, because of this, I'm going to wait. Don't wait.
The governor says the state still has confidence in the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, and he emphasizes the pause is to make sure medical officials are sure about the treatment should there be any adverse reactions. He says during that Tuesday White House phone call, the message was extreme caution to a rare occurrence.
They emphasize that when you're looking at, on a percentage basis, six cases out of 6.8 million doses, that's less than one out of a million chances. Obviously, it's an effective vaccine, but because of that reaction, we want to make sure that the physician community, the healthcare, have the right information on the treatment of any adverse reaction. So that is the reason for the pause, and we'll continue to monitor that.
Arkansas Secretary of Health, Dr. Jose Romero, says for people who have received the J&J vaccine, there are physical signs to pay attention to in the rare case an adverse effect, such as a blood clot, develops.
Based on information that we have now, if it's been a month or more since you've received the Janssen vaccine, your risk is extremely low. For those individuals that are within the first 2 to 3 weeks, signs and symptoms to watch for, the things that you should be looking for, are intense headache, that is a very severe migraine, more severe than you've had in the past or the first time you've had a very severe headache, chest pain, abdominal pain, leg pain. Those things should prompt you to seek medical attention at an emergency room and allow those doctors to go ahead and examine you. In the case that you receive the Janssen vaccine and you do visit an emergency room, please inform the physicians that you've received the Janssen vaccine and how many days or weeks it's been since the dose was given.
Governor Hutchinson says the pause is no reason for Arkansans to take their own pause from getting protected from the virus. He says the state has 245,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine and 178,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine. And he says the state's 63,000 doses of the J&J vaccine are being kept safe and will be ready for distribution when the pause for those shots is lifted. He says about 20% of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are being saved for second shots, and another 20% are reserved for planned mass vaccination clinics. He says the rest are ready for people not yet vaccinated.
And you say, well, why are we not getting more of those out? And the answer is you. We need you to get your vaccination. We have the doses available to get into your arm. Please do not delay. Get your appointment and get it done. There is that opportunity for you, and nothing will slow it down.
There is a statewide hotline to assist people to schedule appointments, 1-800-985-6030. And that same number can be used by people who are homebound to schedule vaccinations to come to them. The governor urged all Arkansans 16 and over to get a shot. About 25% of people 16 and over in the state are fully immunized, another 15% partially vaccinated, meaning nearly two-thirds of people eligible had not yet received a shot. The governor says the state is, again, at a crossroads when it comes to the virus. He pointed to a chart yesterday that used a white line to represent the trajectory of COVID-19 cases in Michigan and an orange line to signify the same in Arkansas.
In December 8th was Michigan's first peak. We were down, of course, then. And then Michigan dropped. And then we went up to our first peak in January 10th. And so our first peak was what? 32 days, 1 month away from Michigan's first peak. And then Arkansas came down after that first peak to where we were in February, and we've continued low. Michigan came down gradually, and they also reached their low point in February. And then Michigan skyrocketed. They went up on that white line to their second peak, which is April 9th. Now, if you looked at what happened on the first peak and Arkansas's peak, We're 32 days apart. The question is, will we go up and peak again, just as we followed Michigan and some of the other states before? We lag behind them in our trend line.
The entire briefing, including comments from other state officials about schools and prisons in Arkansas on the virus, can be viewed at Governor Hutchinson's YouTube channel. This is Ozarks at Large. With about 2 weeks left in an extended legislative session in Little Rock, Arkansas lawmakers have passed several bills that transgender advocates say either directly or indirectly target trans community members, particularly trans youth and athletes. Other bills remain in committee, bills like Senate Bill 347, which would charge health care providers with a felony for providing gender reassignment services like surgery or hormone treatment to minors, and House Bill 1882, which would require schools, arenas, and other publicly owned buildings to require people to use the bathrooms that correspond to the sex at birth. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke to Jennifer Steele, who is a mom with a trans son, about the past couple of months and how people can support a community she says is under attack.
I'd like to start by just asking how you're feeling right now.
Well, there's been a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions. I have been hurt. I have been sad. I have been angry. I have been disgusted. I have been parental because I am a mama and I feel real bad for people. And I know my kid's going to be okay. And I know a lot of kids don't have that kind of support system. And I feel real, real bad for them. And I'm also just confused by why the Republican Party in Arkansas would pick such a group to go after that is doing no one harm at all. I mean, no one. It's a group that is so flies so low and below, you know, the radar most of the time that most people don't even know when they're talking to someone who's trans. And yet that's who the Republican Party has decided to be the out, the other this year.
And how are you and your son talking about all this? How is he feeling?
He's very tired. He's struggling to just, you know, do his normal stuff. He wonders about leaving. He is glad he has this semester off from college because he would not have made it. He is angry. He wants to lash out, but isn't sure where and how to make that work. And he's just exhausted from talking and feeling about it. So a lot of times when he's here, we just don't discuss it. He knows it's happening. We've been to a few protests. He gave authority so that we could speak. He's trying to just take some space to himself and be separate.
Your husband spent a lot of time at the state capitol fighting a different so-called bathroom bill in a past legislative session. What's different about what's happening right now, other than obviously the sheer number of bills that are being introduced and passed?
That was hard, but rational, you know, commentary still held the moment. There is nothing rational about what's happening at the legislature. They do not want to hear what is real. They don't want to know facts. They don't want to hear from trans people or parents. They don't care about the impact. They don't want to hear from doctors. They are just hell-bent on passing whatever legislation they can to erase whatever they need to erase in their psyche about trans people's existence. It doesn't erase anyone. It doesn't change anyone. It just makes people's lives harder. And trans kids particularly already have hard lives. So it is a much worse session. I spent a lot of time in the committee meetings last time, and I've spent several days in the committee meetings this time. It is far more rude, condescending, and just dismissive and hateful. And it does not matter that there's questions from the Democrats, or I can't guarantee every person who's ever questioned was a Democrat, but it is by far the Republican Party pushing this agenda.
What's your message to trans kids and their parents as all this is happening?
I would say that just know that in the trans community, and I don't dream to speak for the trans community, but in this community, there is a lot of support, a lot of love, a lot of knowledge, collective knowledge, in some of these groups, in Transitive, and there are private groups, which if you're trans, you can get to on Facebook. And those are so supportive and they offer such help. And it's generally speaking, older trans people helping younger trans people to navigate what can be really difficult life decisions. So to the trans youth, I would say there is an enormous background of support for them and to fight for them. So they are not alone, no matter how it much might feel like that in a bad, uncomfortable home environment when you're 14. They're not alone. It is not going to stay like this. These laws will not stand. This is going to, frankly, I 100% believe bite the Republican Party in the back because they are overreaching to the point where they're offending far moderate, even conservative Republicans. I mean, if you get the governor vetoing a bill, it means you've gone way too far. So I would just say not to give up hope, just to stay alive, survive, do what you got to do, and just know that it will be better.
Have you been able to find any silver linings in what's taking place?
The silver lining I see is that, you know, the Republican Party just keeps coming. They just keep coming. They're inexplicably attacking children. They're attacking children who are trans and preventing them from getting care that non-trans children get. I mean, it cannot be more clear that they are just on a mission, and I don't believe it's religious-based. I do not. It has nothing to do with religion, and if it does, I don't know that religion. This is about segregationism, frankly. It's about picking somebody to be the other, and unfortunately, you know, they're struggling to keep some other groups in that other, and trans is the one where they're settling on. I don't know if it's their polling. I don't know what. But I think what they've in fact done is create sympathy where there was none for trans families. I think that they have forced trans families to step up and educate non-trans families. So I think that that will work to the trans community's advantage and not the Republican Party's. And I just think that, you know, the possibility of a high turnover in the next election is what gives me hope.
What's your advice to people who are wondering how they can support the trans community and particularly trans youth right now?
I think there's a lot, actually, that can be done in a lot of different ways, depending on people's comfort levels. I think if you're comfortable, I think honestly, if you're not comfortable, you should let your state legislatures know that you do not support them bullying children, and that this is not the best use of their time. And I think that's particularly true in rural Arkansas, because those guys don't want to hear from me. They want to hear from their own constituents, and they're not hearing enough from them. I think that really helps. Arkansans could educate themselves about what it means to be transgender. They're not getting the information straight or clean. They're certainly not getting it from the Arkansas legislature. And I think once they learn a little bit about it, there are tons of resources available if they look, that they should share what they know, because it's not a hidden problem. It's not something to hide or be ashamed of. It's just a thing. I think that, parent or people in general, when you meet someone and you're not sure of their gender, I think that as weird as it sounds, ask, what pronouns do you use? That sounds really odd for somebody old like me to do. And when I first started doing it, it was awkward. But the difference in a trans person's day can go from bad to good because someone knows and uses the proper pronouns. I think that you, if you know a trans youth, I think you, who is in a supportive household, I think you could support his parents or her parents because they are hurting, you know, take them supper, do whatever you can do to give them a minute. If you know a transgender youth who lives in an unsupportive household, I think you should let them know that they have your support and you can define what that means, but that they, that you see them and you support them in how they are living. I think that if you see bullying, and that includes hateful memes that are everywhere, I think that you don't sit quiet and let that go. You say something. I think you just don't let people think it's okay to be hateful. It is not okay. Especially if you're comfortable, if you're cis, if you're, you know, adult, if you are well-established enough that you're not concerned about your next paycheck, use that comfort and use it for good. Don't just sit and enjoy it. I think that the biggest thing is that you let trans youth know that they are loved and that they are seen and that they are respected. And it cannot stop with love. It has to be action. You have to let them know that you are going to fight for them, because your quiet love is a little bit, but it's not going to do what needs to be done to fight what's coming at them. It's an onslaught. And then lastly, if you have money and you're not sure how to do any of those other things, but you just want to give to some groups who will, I have a short list. I've got Intransitive, the Center for Artistic Revolution, Lucy's Place, River Valley Equality Center, Reconcile Arkansas, and Vector Health. All of those groups do a lot of good for a lot of kids and a lot of adults who are trans. And I guess the absolute last thing I would say is, if you've got a lot of money, give it to the ACLU, because they are the trans youth friends right now, and they are the only ones putting it up and fighting each and every one of these bills, and it's a lot.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Seriously, thanks for keeping this out in the open, and thanks for giving a message of hope.
That was Jennifer Steele of Little Rock speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek about the impact the legislative session in Little Rock has had on families with trans children like hers. Yesterday, the Walton Arts Center issued a statement in support of the trans community. It says, quote, "This legislation does not reflect Walton Arts Center's core values and commitment to create inclusive spaces where everyone feels welcome to experience the performing arts. We are committed to working alongside stakeholders across the state to ensure Arkansas laws reflect an inclusive and equitable community."
KUAF is supported by Butterfield Trail Village, Northwest Arkansas's retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being. Amenities and living options from apartments to village homes, plus on-site fitness facilities are available. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for information. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is open each Wednesday through Monday. To maintain social distancing and follow COVID-19 safety protocols, free time ticket reservations are required for entry to the museum. No tickets are needed for the outdoor access of the museum's trails and grounds, which are open from sunrise to sunset. Tickets and more information available at crystalbridges.org.
And thanks for being with us for this midweek session of Ozarks at Large. On tomorrow's show, how schools in Arkansas are embracing solar power as a way to reduce energy bills and their reliance on fossil fuels. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek will have that report for us. And Leah Uribe brings us another edition of Sound Perimeter. That and much more tomorrow at noon and 7 on KUAF 91.3 FM. And always at KUAF.com. No institution wants people to walk all over their most cherished landmark or tradition, except the University of Arkansas. Senior Walk is designed specifically for people to walk on. or run, or bike, or roll. As we continue to take time to commemorate the sesquicentennial of the University of Arkansas, Charlie Allison, Executive Editor for University Relations at the U of A, gives us the mostly concrete history of a unique tradition.
The most hallowed tradition at the University of Arkansas, Senior Walk, came to be more or less as the result of a brawl. In the very early part of the 20th century, students started a short-lived tradition called Pennant Day. Each class, the freshmen, sophomores, juniors, and seniors, created a pennant to celebrate its class. In March 1903, three seniors walked through the university library in Old Main, bearing aloft their senior pennant. On a whim, a junior sprang upon the flag and trampled it on the floor. A spirited fight ensued, and another junior bore off a large piece of the senior pennant. Overnight, the seniors erected a tall pole in the center of campus and hoisted their pennant, or maybe the remnants of it, to the top of the pole. At dawn, the seniors stood in a circle around the pole, ready to defend it from all comers. And come they did, spectators and spoilers alike. Children from Leverett Elementary School, the Depot Rounders from Dixon Street, and of course, the faculty, staff, and students of the university all turned out to watch as well. Then the juniors arrived, and the battle was joined. The Cardinal Yearbook reported that, quote, "Boys were fighting, struggling, and rolling over and over on the ground. After an hour of fruitless struggle, the juniors surrendered and a truce was called. Both classes gathered around the flagpole and gave a college yell with a zeal which showed that college patriotism was even greater than class spirit." Well, maybe. When Pennant Day continued the next year, so campus lore maintains, the juniors of 1904 took their pennant to the rooftops of University Hall with the intention of posting it on as high a point as possible on the main building, all the while fending off juniors from the ramparts of the slate roof and the parapet of the North Tower. By all accounts, the 1904 Pennant Day proved more dangerous and more despicable than the previous year. Rather than let the brawling continue, faculty called on the class of 1905 to abandon the roughhousing of Pennant Day and to propose a new ceremony to celebrate Junior-Senior Day. The senior class and its president, Charles W. Cromwell, proposed to inscribe the names of the senior class in a newly poured block of concrete on the walkway leading from Arkansas Avenue to the front door of Old Main. The walkway at the time was pea gravel, and the addition of blocks each year would allow the central artery to campus to become paved over the years. The class of 1905 included the names of all 38 members of the senior class, regardless of whether they had finished a degree or not. The class of 1904 saw what had happened and soon asked to add their block, which was allowed. And then for the next 20 years, each new class added the names of its class officers and members to a newly poured block of cement each spring. Someone with a good hand and a good sense of lettering inscribed each name in the walk with a wooden stylus. Joe Bell Holcomb, an 1898 graduate and the first dean of women, recalled that after each slab was completed, seniors assembled on either side of the walk. The class president dedicated the section, and the group pledged allegiance to the university. After several years, the ceremony was discontinued because some of the students felt it too sentimental. In 1910, the Board of Trustees approved a regulation that limited the names on Senior Walk to students who received degrees. By 1919, the process took about 5 hours to mix and pour the concrete and then write the 47 names of the class members. One writer described the scene. When rain began falling, the jolly crowd betook themselves to the shelter of the tent, which had been erected to protect the soft cement. Here they made the night merry with college songs. From the 1920s into the 1960s, the Department of Mechanical Engineering cast the brass numerals for each new class year. Robert Jeske, a professor of mechanical engineering hired in 1947, recalled that casting the numerals was his first job as a faculty member. Faculty and students poured molten brass into the molds they had made for the numerals, each of which stands about 9 1/4 inches tall. In 1925, the tradition changed slightly. Instead of the senior class writing an ever-growing list of names into freshly poured concrete, the university began adding the names of the graduating class through a mechanical process, using raised brass letters to impress the names into wet concrete all at once. The sidewalks were poured with two layers of concrete, a first layer with a variety of aggregate mixed in, and then an upper layer with nothing larger than sand, so that the imprint of names could be crisp. In 1930, a member of the Board of Trustees, Fred Brown, who was a 1902 alumnus, asked whether the earlier classes shouldn't be added. And then he spearheaded a fundraising drive to install the classes from 1876 to 1903. Due to the alphabetical listing, the name of Nettie Barnett became the first name on Senior Walk. If you're looking at those earlier years, you might notice that there's no class in grade for 1887 and 1895. My understanding is that commencement was switched from spring to winter in 1887, so the graduating class ended up receiving their degrees in early 1888. And then in 1895, commencement was switched back. And again, graduates skipped ahead to a spring graduation ceremony. By 1964, the longest name on Senior Walk was that of Charles Schmeniel Plinig, class of 1906. His name might be a symbol of what had become a labor-intensive, time-consuming chore. The ever-lengthening list of annual graduates and the high number of construction projects elsewhere on campus caused the university to hold off installation of another class for 7 years. Even though installation resumed in the 1970s, university administrators began consideration of whether to abandon the tradition altogether. In 1987, though, Francis Hull, a university locksmith, came up with a time-saving idea. He suggested sandblasting the names into hardened concrete walks, and Art Calico, the foreman of the carpentry shop, led a team of tinkerers into what turned out to be an 8-year-long invention of a new machine, the Senior Sandhog. This new machine blasted sand through a rubberized stencil of a graduate's name, engraving it in the side beneath. As the machine rolls forward for the next name, it also vacuums up the sand for reuse. Soon, Senior Walk had caught up with the graduating classes. Then the names of university presidents, chancellors, trustees, and recipients of honorary degrees were also added near the entrances to Silas Hunt Hall. The latter list of honorary degrees includes such well-known people as composer William Grant Still, Her Royal Highness Queen Noor of Jordan, and architect Edward Durrell Stone. By 2020, Senior Walk contained more than 200,000 names covering 4 miles of sidewalk, or 8 miles if you're reading the names in both directions. End to end, the names could stretch all the way to Fort Smith, and they continue to grow at the rate of about 50,000 names per decade. With the sandblasting of names came the opportunity to also get slightly longer names into the walk. Two members of the class of 1999, Vladimir Alexandrovich Kobza and Juan Sayadatul Imawan Ibrahim, can now claim title to the longest name, depending on whether you include spaces in the count or not. Across the campus, names offer a smorgasbord of ethnicities from around the world, with occasional rhymes like Lester Jester and Ming Ching Ting, humorous nicknames such as Haphazard and Dan the Man Shurich. Razorback-centric names like Pigs and Hogs, and famous names belonging to Oliver Wendell Holmes, Susan Anthony, Daniel Boone, Orville Wright, and James T. Kirk. For these last five, of course, only their names were famous. And, of course, for the last one, the fame owed only to a fictional Starfleet commander. Today, you yourself can look for more interesting names, or your own name, on the new digital version of Senior Walk, where you can also find locations and see 360-degree images of each class's location. Go to the sesquicentennial site, 150.uark.edu, that's 150.uark.edu, and scroll down for the Senior Walk link.
Charlie Allison is executive editor at University Relations at the University of Arkansas. And almost every Wednesday, he is sharing stories about the first 150 years of the U of A. You can find out about more observations of the sesquicentennial at 150.uark.edu. That's the number, 150.uark.edu.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. An East Arkansas refuge contains the largest remaining tract of bottomland hardwood forest in North America. In the 1970s, the Corps of Engineers planned to dredge and straighten several miles of the Cache River to reduce flooding. Stuttgart Dennis and duck hunter Rex Hancock formed a group to fight the plan, and in 1986, the area was made the Cache River National Wildlife Refuge, ensuring its preservation. In 1990, the United Nations Ramsar Convention deemed the site as wetlands of international importance. The 62,000-acre refuge is home to around 350 animal species and includes lands in Jackson, Monroe, Prairie, and Woodruff counties, with plans to expand as land becomes available. In 2004, an ivory-billed woodpecker, long thought extinct, was spotted in the refuge. The Cache River National Wildlife Refuge is popular with hunters, fishermen, photographers, and wildlife lovers, and attracts around 120,000 visitors each year. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
This is Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow morning on Morning Edition, Karen Gibson held top intelligence posts in the United States military before joining a security review of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Now, she's the new Sergeant-at-Arms for the United States Senate. What's her plan to secure the halls of Congress? That conversation's the news that takes place overnight and much more on Morning Edition. From NPR News, tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Some news from Oklahoma released late this morning. The Oklahoma State Department of Health reports 406 new cases of the virus have been detected in the most recent 24 hours of testing in the Sooner State. 25 deaths were added to Oklahoma's list of fatalities from coronavirus. That means 8,093 Oklahomans have died from COVID-19. University of Arkansas MFA playwright candidate Lauren Faribi's play, Goods, has been selected as the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival's 2021 recipient of the Planet Earth Arts Playwriting Award, as well as nominated for the festival's National Partners in American Theater Award. Additionally, Goods will make its virtual world premiere May 5th at a theater in Chicago. The Planet Earth Arts Playwriting Award, created in partnership with the Planet Earth Arts Foundation, is given to plays that discuss sustainability and address the most urgent environmental and social justice issues of our time through the lens of arts and human creativity. And this reminder, KUAF presents Classical Music tonight at 8 with Peter Vandegraaff. Every Sunday through Thursday night, you can join Peter beginning at 8 and lasting all the way till 5 the next morning for the best classical music he can find. And you can find classical music 24 hours a day on KUAF2. Our round-the-clock classical music HD station. You can find KUAF2 on your HD radio for free at home or in your car or at KUAF.com. Or if you have a smart speaker, you can ask it to please play KUAF2.
It's the Community Spotlight on KUAF. I'm Pete Hartman. Once again, over the phone, we're happy to be joined with Dr. Sayard Evans, Chief Executive Officer with the Arkansas Support Network. Nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to talk to you. So Arkansas Support Network is a statewide disability service provider. We are a home and community-based service provider. So all of the supports that we provide those in traditional family settings, individual settings. We don't provide any residential or segregated services. And we were founded in 1988 by a group of five moms who all had kids with disabilities, who all looked around in 1988 and said, this service system is not what we want for our kids. We don't want our kids to have to be segregated and isolated to get the support that they need.
Now, just recently, the Arkansas DHS has granted a license to y'all, which will allow y'all increased opportunities. Describe what this will do.
Arkansas and lots of other states, but Arkansas maybe a little bit more than even other states, has long struggled with a siloed service system, particularly for folks who have an intellectual or developmental disability and also a behavioral health or psychiatric disability. And so for a long time within our Medicaid codes, our state Medicaid structures, we struggled with a kind of a rule out based on primary diagnosis. So if you were an individual who was diagnosed both with an intellectual disability and then also, say, schizophrenia, you could only access, Medicaid would only allow you to access services based on your primary diagnosis, which meant that if you, you know, if that primary diagnosis was schizophrenia, you could access the mental health service system. But then when you went to apply for developmental disability services and supports, you would be denied. Essentially, what this new provider type does is it allows for a provider to provide services across that entire umbrella, from DD services to behavioral health services. And so we're thrilled, we're excited about the opportunity to be able to innovate services, actually put resources to innovating services that can meet people where they're at and really provide
holistic supports for folks that have complex needs to be able to live in the community.
And again, I guess if someone's listening and maybe want to inquire about services, possibly help them out, supports.org?
Supports.org. We actually have a section on our website, a referral form, and it's not, referral is a pretty formal word, but we encourage anybody who is just needing to network around disability services. We're really committed to, you know, if we're not the place that can help you, we will certainly work with you and try to get you plugged into where you can.
Arkansas Support Network, speaking with Dr. Sayard Evans, the Chief Executive Officer. Always nice to talk to you. Thanks for letting us know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I always enjoy it, and I appreciate the opportunity.
KUAF Public Radio and the Community Spotlight, Local Matters.
All right, before we end this Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large, let's repeat some numbers and facts that we had earlier on our show. There are the Northwest Arkansas Council-sponsored clinics for people looking for a first Pfizer shot to get vaccinated against COVID-19 taking place tomorrow and Friday. The first clinic will be tomorrow from 8 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. This is going to take place in the former Sears Center in the Northwest Arkansas Mall in Fayetteville. You can reach that destination through Ozark Regional Transit, of course, and ORT's fees for 2021 are zero. A second clinic is scheduled for Friday at the J.B. Hunt headquarters in Lowell. That clinic is from 8 in the morning Friday until 1 Friday afternoon. Registration for either clinic can be made online at nwacouncil.org/NWA vaccines. nwacouncil.org/NWA vaccines. You can also call to register. It's a 479 area code, and the number is 334-2929. And for information about scheduling a vaccination anywhere in the state of Arkansas, there continues to be a vaccination hotline. It is toll-free. That number, 800-985-6030. 800-985-6030. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Bella Vista. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Contributors to our Wednesday show this week included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, Zuzanna Sitek, and Charlie Allison. Timothy Dennis produced today's show, Next Door, Masked and Socially Distanced, in the Harold and Blanche Koch News Studio. The Community Spotlight is produced by Pete Hartman. You can hear new editions of the Community Spotlight each weekday morning inside Morning Edition at 6:30 and 8:30. Also tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30, you can hear newscasts involving news from our state and region. Our thanks this Wednesday to Mark Christ for the most recent Encyclopedia of Arkansas History segment. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl is often playing live and sometimes taking requests on his Facebook and Instagram feeds. DarylSean.com is where you can also find out more about him and his most recent releases. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 for a brand new Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large. We are available as a podcast, too, so you can listen to us whenever you'd like. That podcast is free, and it's available through all the major podcast distributors. You can always find our show as well at ozarksatlarge.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for your continued support and being with us. We'll be back again tomorrow.